Hello, it's Tuesday the 11th of May. I'm Andrew Pearce and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we'll be talking about house prices. They've gone up by the biggest amount since 2016. Great if you own one, not so good if you're a first-time buyer. Morrisons, 100% increase in their online sales. We're talking about the green list of holiday destinations and asking why are countries such as Greece, Spain and Italy that we want to go to not on that list. I'm talking to the BBC technology correspondent, Rory Coughlan-Jones, who's been diagnosed with cancer and Parkinson's. But first, we're talking about care homes. So from Monday, care home residents in England will be able to reunite with five different friends or family members, and they'll also have greater freedom to see loved ones and go on trips without the need to isolate. For months, if not a year, residents have been subject to severe restrictions, which have led to sharp deteriorations in their mental and physical health. I'm joined now by Nikki Gerard. She's a best-selling crime writer and she's the co-founder of John's Campaign. Nikki, nearly there now. Are the changes, are the relaxations enough for you?
Are we nearly there? So every time new guidance is issued, there's a little moment when we think, oh, phew, this is getting better. And then we look at the details and we look at how it's rolled out across the country and we realise that there are still restrictions in place which are entirely wrong and unacceptable and mean that there's a whole section of society which is being discriminated against. So, you know, we always welcome kind of changes that mean there are fewer restrictions on people who are living in care homes. And unfortunately, we are always saying this is really not enough yet.
What are the restrictions that are still there, Nikki, which you think are unfair?
So, I mean, if I can, I'll give you an example.
Yes, please.
So in our legal challenge to the government, our last legal challenge, we made it very clear that we were extending it and we weren't just thinking about people in care homes who are old, who had dementia, although they're the largest, kind of the majority of people who live in care homes belong to that category. But there are also people, young people or younger people, who aren't kind of threatened unduly by COVID, no more than the rest of us, but who have specific difficulties, which mean they have to live in a home. And we find it entirely wrong that those people need to remain kind of in a home, only allowed out to go to kind of walks in parks, to sit in gardens, to go to kind of daycare centres, but not allowed to go to their own home. So we've had anguished messages from parents, for instance, who were saying, I mean, there's one mother who wrote to us about her son, who's in a care home 160 miles away. It's the only one that's suited to his particular very severe needs. And they have to drive that far in order to see him outside. They can't take him back home. Why not? Why not? Why is that person, because they live in a home, less able to do the things that we're all being allowed to
yeah.
do? You just going to have to think, what does a home mean? Why do people who live in these homes, why do they have to be treated as if they are less able to make decisions for themselves, as if they are less able to have the freedoms that we're suddenly all being offered? Honestly,
it sounds more like a prison.
Well, I mean, people, I got quite a lot of flak early on in the pandemic in one of the pieces I wrote for comparing care homes to prisons, and now I'm not getting any flack when I say that, because actually more and more people who live in care homes or who have loved ones who live in care homes are talking about them as prisons. I mean, the 14-day rule, which was kind of enforced self-isolation if they dared step outside the front door, what's that is a prison. And they're not just like prisons, they're like being in solitary confinement inside a prison. Very often people are actually confined to their rooms for 14 days.
I mean, Nikki, what would have happened, do you think, if care homes thought, to hell with this law, to hell with what the government's decided, we're going to use common sense here and some compassion and allow our residents to do to go out and not have to isolate for 14 days when they get back, would they have got into big trouble? Have homes got into trouble for it?
I know what would have happened, because it has happened in some homes.
Right.
And there are some homes who, all the way through the pandemic, have behaved with great compassion and common sense, and they've taken the right precautions. They've really been careful. They have not had kind of more COVID outbreaks or any COVID, you know, more than other homes. And it's been fine. Of course it's been fine, because actually the people who bring COVID into care homes, they are not the family members. That is not how COVID has been entering care homes. It's because you have kind of casualised staff coming in, and we all know that. So I know what would have happened, which is that people in care homes would have been happier, would have been healthier, would have been less lonely, wouldn't have suffered the deteriorations that we've been hearing about. They wouldn't have died on their own. And that it, you know, all the things that we've been urging could have happened all the way through the pandemic. It could have been done better. And, you know, and I know that care homes have been put into an impossible situation, and the guidance has been very restrictive, and they're very anxious about the risks of it. But the risk of having COVID, which is now very, very small, A, the numbers are very low, and B, everyone in care homes has been able to have their double vaccination. You know, those risks are very low, but the risk of depression, of mental health deterioration, of kind of all the kind of illnesses that can come through kind of loneliness and social disconnection. Those risks are enormous, and they go on being enormous.
I read somewhere, it was heartbreaking, and somebody said, my mother died of a broken heart in the care home because she couldn't see anybody.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people say, can you die of a broken heart? You can die of a broken heart. And people have been dying of broken hearts. You know, death by sadness. And we've seen such a spike in death from dementia. And I can think of no other reason for that other than this social disconnection. And also, lots of people in care homes who have dementia, they don't know. You know, they might be told over and over and over again. A lot of them do not know why they're not being visited anymore, and they feel they've been punished or abandoned. They feel people have stopped loving them. What a terrible way to end their long life. What a terrible, terrible way to die. I mean, I think that people in care homes need more freedom now than the rest of us, because they've had such a horridly awful year. They don't need less freedom.
Well, and Nikki, I gather the campaign will continue, I imagine. You're going to continue to campaign.
It will continue until we feel that people who live in care homes are not being discriminated against. And there's quite a long way to go on that, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, Nikki, fight the good fight. That's Nikki Gerard, best-selling crime writer, and she's the co-founder of John's Campaign. If you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, and we hope you do, we'd like you to subscribe to us. You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify, and you can get in touch by tweeting us at MailPlus, or you can tweet me at ToryBoyPierce. Foreign holidays are restarting next week. Hurrah, we say to that, but with a very restricted green list of countries, which includes that well-known travel hotspot Brunei and the Falkland Islands, all 8,000 miles away. Let's all go now. Analysis by the Mail has shown that less than 1% of arrivals from European holiday hotspots such as Greece, Spain and Italy are testing positive for COVID. So why can't we go there? I'm joined now by the Mail's travel editor, Mark Palmer. Mark, we saw the Prime Minister last night. He held out very little hope there's going to be any change in that travel green list anytime soon.
Yes, he said that, and I think he was deliberately being cautious, but he is under quite a lot of pressure now, increasingly from tour operators, from the big boys, from British Airways, EasyJet, people like that, because as we've said in the past, that we were always told that once infection rates are coming down, once you've got two-thirds of the adult population vaccinated, that things would shift. I have to say, Andrew, I've been a great pushing very hard to open up the skies and everything else. And in fact, I am going on, as a matter of principle, I think more than anything else, on Monday, I'm going to Lisbon.
Right.
Just to see how it all works.
Yes.
and everything else.
It's a lovely city.
It's a lovely city. I haven't been there for ages. But I've started to, well, we're now Tuesday, aren't we? And I'm leaving on next Monday. And I've started the process of the tests and ordering the kits and everything else.
Yeah. So you can write a piece about that.
I have to say, it's not easy. It's complicated.
Yeah.
It's expensive. You have to have a test 72 hours before you go. Fine, that's got to be positive.
Yeah.
You've got to take with you the lateral flow test. You do that, and then I hadn't realised is that somebody then zooms you from the UK to check that you are still negative.
And what? So you have to show them. Can you show them your lateral flow test on Zoom?
Yeah, you show them.
Okay.
And so I guess.
But how do they know it's your lateral flow test?
Well,
how do they know you didn't acquire it from
well,
someone?
Well, I don't know. I'll be able to tell you next week.
Yeah.
And then you come back. And then it's after 2 days now, I'm going to have another PCR test.
Mm.
I'm looking at various sites, and some of them, for all of that, for my trip to Lisbon next week, all of that is going to cost me about £250.
And that's without the flight?
And that's without the flight, and that's just a glass of anything.
Yeah, and that's just you. So if you were going with Mrs. Palmer, that's... £500 on all the tests,
absolutely.
Plus your flight.
Absolutely.
Plus, makes it really expensive.
They
keep saying they're going to get these tests down in price, Mark, but it's not happened yet.
No, it's not. I think you've got to shop around, and I think I went to sort of the easy option, and they actually will come. They're going to come, I think, on Thursday to the office here to give me my test. And it's a sort of, Rolls Royce service, if you like, but it's very expensive. But I'm sure there are other ways. So, I think what we can do is we can just hope that we've now got, two more weeks, I think, until the first review.
Yes.
And then hopefully there will be I think the biggest thing that they've got to grasp is that you've got to differentiate between sort of mainland Greece and some of these islands. Some of these islands have had no infections
at all. I know. It's extraordinary. And you can fly directly there.
You can fly directly there. Obviously, they're worried if you go there, then you're going to go elsewhere.
Yeah.
But you're not. You're not really going to do that. You know, if we're going on holiday to Crete, for example, very low infections there. Why not let people go there and give these travel companies some sort of lifeline?
Yeah, and the countries on the list, Brunei. Oh, let's all go there then.
Yeah,
not very safe if you're gay, of course, which I know you're not, but I am. And so it wouldn't be very safe for me. Australia and New Zealand's on the list, but you can't get. They're not letting people in.
No.
And Saint Helena. Great, but the government built that airport and the runway's too small and the planes can't land there.
No,
so,
absolutely.
So that's not happening.
Other places, the Faroe Islands, I've never been to.
Where are they,
intrigued,
Mark? I had to get an atlas to check where they were.
They're sort of off the coast. Somewhere between here and Denmark, basically.
Yeah,
stuck out in the North Sea.
They're a Danish territory, I discovered.
They're a Danish territory, and quite quirky. They're a bit like the Orkneys are, I think, for us. They don't like being Danish. They have their own language. So it's their moment in the sun, I suppose, that they can attract people.
You could send me there to write a travel piece if you want.
Well, fine enough, I already have commissioned that, Andrew.
Yeah, I'm not surprised,
I'm
a bit slow. I was a bit slow off the I think I'd rather you set me somewhere hotter,
We're going to send you on another cruise as soon as cruising starts, Andrew.
That would be great.
Off you go.
But I suspect too, because the... June the 21st is when everything is being lifted. I suspect before then, the Prime Minister will have announced some concessions on travelling abroad.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that the so-called green list will expand hugely. Mm-hmm. And I think Spain, Italy, and the other one which I think is interesting is in America. I don't understand why America isn't actually on the green list now, frankly, because they've done
brilliantly with their vaccine.
And I think that British Airways, that's such an important run for them. So they're pushing hard.
They have to do it soon because the President of the United States is coming here for the summit, the G7 summit down in Cornwall, and that's in June. So it has to be on the list by then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, otherwise, that's going to cause a bit of a rumpus with the president.
Although the president, knowing the president, he might well get on the wrong plane and find himself somewhere completely different.
What are you suggesting about President Biden? You're suggesting he gets a bit mixed up. That's lovely Mark Palmer, who is the travel editor of the Daily Mail. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show, or visit mailsubscriptions.co.uk to get access to every Daily Mail piece, plus exclusive podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and more. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So house prices have bucked the trend with the pandemic. They've soared by 8.4%. It's the highest rate of growth since 2016. It's thought the surge in prices is due to families saving more in lockdown and being more confined to their houses for a year. I'm joined now by Jeremy Leaf, who's a North London estate agency owner, and he was the residential chairman of the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors. Jeremy, is it because people have been locked down at home, they've decided they want to now move house? Is that what's happening? Is there, or is it all to do with the stamp duty holiday?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, yeah, the stamp duty holiday is a huge bribery and corruption, always gets people moving.
Yeah,
why not?
Of course.
But people are being in lockdown, they're aware of unsuitable homes and relationships, and they want to move to places more suited to their new working patterns.
That's interesting, isn't it? Did you think when we went into this terrible lockdown, Jeremy, that it might have a depressing effect on house prices and it might actually adversely impact sales?
Absolutely. We fell off a cliff 12 months ago. We were closed for 2 months. People were desperately trying to move and they couldn't finish moves. And they couldn't even rent property. No one knew where they were. We were in a terrible state and no one knew what was going to happen. And fortunately, we came out of it and it revealed how many people really did want to move. And even in difficult circumstances, a lot of moves finally went through.
And the stamp duty holiday, that's still with us for a few more weeks, I think. Is that still keeping the momentum going?
Yes, it's one of the factors. I think once people get the bit between their teeth and they decide they really want to move on, then there's not much you can hold them back. Because, of course, we're still busy with people making inquiry to move, and many of them will have little prospect of taking advantage of the stamp duty holiday. But there's others caught in the backlog of the system, the conveyancing, searches, surveys, lenders, and so on, who are going to struggle to make it, but it's due to end at the end of June, or at least start tapering off from the end of June.
What does this say, though, this increase, 8.4%? Great for somebody like me who's got my own property. But if you're somebody who's trying to get a foot on the ladder, the proverbial first-time buyer, this is pretty difficult, isn't it, Jeremy?
Very much so, and it's very difficult. We were looking in the Queen's Speech for more help for affordable housing to buy and to rent, and there really wasn't much evidence of it, only sort of fairly bland pronouncements about trying to improve the system and supply. But that is a big issue, and I think that's one of the reasons why people have been so desperate to get onto the housing ladder and take advantage not just of the stamp duty but the high loan to value mortgages, which the government have backed. And that's given people confidence that the government actually has a stake in keeping house prices up, which I feel sorry for the poor old first time buyer trying to get on the ladder maybe a year or two's time.
Now, what about that 5% mortgage for first time buyers that the government is guaranteeing? I know it's just started. Is there much evidence that people are taking it up, Jeremy?
There is. The criteria are not easy. Again, the headlines are good, and there are quite a lot of mortgages around. There's more mortgages are more plentiful than they have been for a while. But the new scheme, it's early days yet, and lenders are still being a little bit cautious, because naturally, if they feel that prices are going to perhaps correct after the stamp duty starts to taper away, then they're going to be a bit more nervous of getting a commitment there.
And just finally, is there any particular area of the country, Jeremy, where prices are soaring fastest, or is it pretty even across the country?
The activity and prices seem to be rising faster outside the major towns and cities, because that's where people are choosing to live in these new arrangements as part of. So outside towns and cities, really, that's been the popular places where they can work from home comfortably, take advantage of green space and greener settings, and walk to many places which perhaps they only had to drive to before.
One of the many changes wreaked by COVID, of course.
Well, COVID, of course, is a big driver of that change as well. But I think, interestingly, what we've found on the ground is that some people who we thought had left for good, perhaps London or outside London, are starting to trickle back, because they only rented for a while, because they weren't sure, naturally, of their working arrangements. And now the bosses are starting to say, well, yes, some of them are going back virtually full-time, and others are shifting between working from home and working in the office. So then now they can see a slightly more permanent arrangement. So some of them are trickling back into towns and cities again.
Very interesting. That's Jeremy Leaf, who is a North London estate agent. Thanks for joining us. Now it's time for our regular city update with Hugo Duncan, no less, who is the deputy business editor at the Daily Mail. Hugo Morrison's high hopes for a good British summer.
Well, that's right, Andrew. We've had an update from Morrison's today, which is quite upbeat. It covers the last 14 weeks, which of course includes the easing of some lockdown restrictions on April the 12th. And they've reported a increased sales of over 5%, online sales up more than 100%. So they've more than doubled. Now, this, of course, is as a result of the pandemic, of lockdown, people internet shopping and getting their groceries delivered. But within this update, there are signs that life is beginning to return to something like normal. Fuel sales, for example, Morrison says, are now very close to where they were before the pandemic struck. Now, this suggests people are getting back into their cars, they're going to work, they're doing the school run, they're going to see friends, they're going back to the shops. Also, what they describe as food to go sales have also picked up strongly. Now, that is sandwiches, sushi, salads, crisps, drinks.
Stuff people take to go to work.
It's what people have at their desks for lunch. Another sign that people are heading back to the office. And the boss, Dave Potts, is pretty bullish about what is coming for the summer. He says the pandemic is in retreat, which we hope is correct. He says customers are in the mood to spend. They've been fed up of being locked up for however long we have been locked up for. And he says the nation has a summer of socialising and sport to look forward to.
That's good. Barbecues, all that sort of stuff, all good for Morrison's.
Absolutely.
What's your supermarket? I go to Waitrose. That's the nearest. That's my nearest one.
We have Sainsbury's, Tesco's, and
you're sport for choice.
There's a few just quite close.
You can't remember the others. You don't go to the supermarket, do you, Hugo?
We get it delivered.
That's Hugo Duncan. He is the deputy business editor of the Daily Mail with positive news from Morrison's. So in May 2019, the BBC's accomplished technology correspondent Rory Coughlin-Jones announced he'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Soon after that, he was told a cancerous tumour he'd had since 2005 had grown. Rory says his hobby is researching cutting-edge treatments, and he uses an app to remind him to take his medication. And he joins me now. Rory, how are you doing?
I'm not doing too badly, Andrew. I've kind of got used to having these conditions and also using technology or trying to work out ways which technology can help me. I mean, the pill reminder's a classic example. You know, we live our life by apps these days, don't we? And I've got an app that makes a rattling pill noise every 4 hours, reminding me what to do.
Oh, right. And how many pills are you taking a day, Rory?
Well, I take, I'm trying to remember, three the first time and then one the second, third and fourth time. There's a well-known medication called Sinemet, basic Parkinson's medication, which basically gives you a dopamine shot to ward off the effects of Parkinson's.
Right. And Rory, I mean, you've extraordinary, despite your condition, you've managed to write a book about the rise of the smartphone and the impact of social media, which has been extraordinary, of course, and you're still doing your job as BBC technology correspondent.
Yeah, I mean, writing the book was extraordinary in that I did take a month off to start on it and retreated to my attic in West London. And then soon after I came out of the attic to go back to the normal job and try to keep writing the book too, I was sent back because we went into lockdown. And so it's been, you know, intense writing the book, still making a weekly radio program, still doing everything I normally do, all from this loft in West London.
I think I know your loft very well now, Rory, because I've seen you on the TV so often. I think that's a very nice loft space. The Parkinson's, why does somebody get Parkinson's, Rory? Do we know? Is it hereditary or not?
There are all sorts of theories. One of the slightly depressing things about Parkinson's is the main drug was sort of invented about 50-odd years ago, and there have been great advances in that. The knowledge of how to diagnose it or where it actually comes from is still pretty hazy. Yes, there's potentially a genetic element. My dad had Parkinson's, but he had it at a very advanced age when he was already ill with various other things. And I'm actually taking part in a genetic study where they're trying to work out whether there is an element of that. I've been and visited an amazing brain bank in West London where they dissect the brains of people who died of Parkinson's, and they think they've detected, for instance, extra iron in the brains of people with Parkinson's. They don't know how it got there, so they're looking at drugs which might remove that. But there's a lot of research going on, but to be frank, there hasn't been a huge amount of progress until recently.
And you're very young, aren't you, to have Parkinson's? I know I've got an uncle who's got Parkinson's, and he's 75, 76, and it was diagnosed a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit young. There is something called early onset, and I don't think I'm quite there. I've got a good mate who works at who was the darts commentator at Sky, Dave Clark, and he got it in his late 40s, early 50s.
Did he really?
And Michael J. Fox, of course, famously was diagnosed.
Yes, of course.
In his early 30s. So there are those people who have to live with it a long time. And it's just so various and such a wide spectrum of symptoms. I consider myself quite fortunate because I was diagnosed 2 years ago now, and my symptoms seem to be pretty much the same. A little worse, maybe. I drag my foot. I'm terrible at typing because it affects my right hand, but then I was pretty bad. And I maybe take a little longer over things than I used to. You know, if somebody says I've got to have a story up in the next half hour, I sweat a little because I'm not as fast as I used to be.
Right. But do you feel, apart from that you slowed up a little bit, Rory, does it manifest itself in any other way in your life? I mean, does it make you feel ill?
It doesn't make me feel ill. It makes me feel a bit shaky. I used to run, for example. I used to do my kind of exercise. I used to do the odd half marathon, and I can't do that anymore. But I still get a lot of exercise. They're very adamant, the doctors and people you meet, because there's a wonderful part of the community, that lots of exercise is a really good idea. So I do, you know, early morning walk with the dog. I do a Pilates class on Saturday. I have a personal trainer on a Sunday. I've just actually come from doing a fitness class in front of the TV to speak to you.
Right.
So I do my best that way. So I'm trying not to let it affect me too much. Obviously, it slows you down a bit, and I don't sleep very well. That's one of the worst things.
Oh, that's really rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tell us, and just before we let you go, Roy, tell us about your book. What's it called?
It's called Always On, Hope and Fear in the Social Smartphone Era. And it's basically what I've seen since I was there when Steve Jobs unveiled the iPhone in 2007.
Right.
Which marked the beginning of this extraordinary era when all these things came together. I mean, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and the iPhone were all born within a few years of each other. And it's a reflection on the massive changes they brought for good. And then there's a sort of story arc. Then we bring in all the bad things. And then it ends in the pandemic year when it's all been thrown into relief, really, where we've seen how vital that kind of communications is, but also the way it's been used to spread damaging misinformation about things like the vaccines.
Well, the best of luck with the book. We'll give it another plug, Rory. It's Always On, Hope and Fear in the Social Smartphone Era by Rory Coughlin-Jones. And it's out now, I think, isn't it?
Out Thursday, but probably available in the bookshops, in a few bookshops already.
Very good. Very good. Best of luck with it, Rory, and stay healthy. Stay as healthy as you can. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Andrew.
That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, you can download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.